Greetings and post-mortal computations, my fine listeners, and welcome to this June 2013 Science News Update. I'm your host for this pre-SOFA-Con Science podcast, Jim Campanella. Before any actual science, let me answer a question that several listener emails have posed. You guys want to know if I'm going to be on the SOFA-Con panel, and the answer is that I'm very sorry, but I am not. Tony Smith has been trying to convince me to do it for a while, but I have had several reasons to turn him down. First and foremost is the amount of time involved in preparing a decent visual presentation. It would take several times longer to prepare anything visual than what I spend now preparing one of these audio recordings each month. Tony, of course, answered, no need, just get up there and talk. But I couldn't do that. I'd have to have a complete accompanying PowerPoint presentation. I mean, nobody wants to see my ugly puss as a talking head for half an hour without any visuals. It grieves me that I don't have the time to do something better. Second, despite the fact that I do talk to groups of students for a living, I am simply not comfortable doing it live on camera. No, I can't explain it, but I'm frankly freaked out with a camera in my face. Third, I do not have a quality microphone, camera, / computer setup that would be acceptable for such a conference. Strangely enough, the computer I use exclusively to record podcasts is about 10 years old. It works with fantastic fidelity, but it has no internet capabilities at all. I have never been able to find its match in a newer computer as far as sound is concerned, which makes no sense to me, since you would expect new computers to be better, not worse. Every other computer I've used for recording sounds like I'm speaking through a tin can. I have no idea why the same high-end microphone would work beautifully with one computer and not others. To sum it up, I discussed this with a friend of mine who noted succinctly, quote, "Oh, so you're like the Beatles in their last couple of years. You're just a studio act. You don't go on tour," unquote. Precisely. That is me. Sorry, folks, but unless things change, I don't tour. Let's get on with science. First story of the night was reported by Science Weekly today, and I'm passing it on to you. You may consider it barely a science story and more of a tech story, but I'm intrigued because scenarios such as the one I'm about to relate have gone through my mind late at night while staring drearily at a dark ceiling, unable to sleep. Let's say that I have spent months narrating a novel. The whole thing is now up on my website, but it has not been premiered yet to the public. And then I get hit by a truck. Well, what happens to my podcast? It will never see the light of day because I am as dead as a doorknob, and no one else has full access to my website. If I'm smart, I had a will that included a beneficiary for my website, email, and passwords. If I lack such foresight, then my dulcet tones for that last bookcast will be forever lost to the world. I am not the only one who has thought of such problems. In April, Google started a new inactive account manager for several of their owned websites, which lets you designate an heir who will control your Google data when you die. Obviously, this does not work universally for personal websites, only for Google sites, but it is still very cool. You choose a length of inactivity, a month, 2 months, a year, 2 years, and if your accounts are ever to go quiet for that chosen time period, Google will notify your heirs that they've inherited access to your Gmail correspondence, your YouTube videos, your Picasa photo albums, whatever you specify that they have control over. A number of services can help with digital estate planning by designating password recipients or deleting accounts or files when you die. But communication and privacy laws have yet to catch up with technology. While Facebook made it possible for family members to convert the page of a loved one into a memorial a few years ago, the company has faced multiple lawsuits from family members who wanted deeper access to their kids' Facebook accounts after a sudden death. So apparently, Facebook may want to think about a similar service to Google. Clearly, it's important for people to consider who will have access and control over their digital data when the time comes. But this focus on privacy and access ignores the emotional significance of a loved one's digital legacy. Studies by Dr. William Odom of Carnegie Mellon University suggest that there may be something fundamental and ancient about how we interact with our items left behind by the dead. While there currently aren't any easy ways to curate digital heirlooms, people still try. Odom says that many people enact similar rituals with digital objects that people use with material ones. He accounts that one woman had 25 or so cherished text messages from her dead husband. She kept the SIM card, an old phone, in an ornate box, and would take them out and read them from time to time. If you think that is a bit macabre, how about this one? A woman from England buried her husband with his cell phone and then kept sending him texts after he died. Romantic, but a bit creepy for my taste. Odom and his colleagues conclude that bereavement in the digital age might be easier if we had devices that allowed us to interact with digital objects in the same way that humans have interacted with heirlooms throughout the ages. As one woman who didn't like the idea of storing special digital photos on a CD remarked, quote, "They deserve better than that," unquote. Based on comments like that one, the researchers have designed three devices that display a deceased person's photos, tweets, and other digital heirlooms on screens embedded in oak veneer boxes. Well, how about some slightly harder science news for the week? This month, the Supreme Court of the U.S. ruled that you cannot patent naturally occurring genes in the human genome. That means that simply planting your flag in a gene and saying that it belongs to you is not going to cut it anymore. That will not be recognized legally. However, let's make something clear. The court unanimously ruled last week that human genes are not patentable. However, it made a clear distinction between naturally occurring gene sequences and those created synthetically in a lab. The Supreme Court case questioned the validity of two patents held by a Salt Lake City biotechnology company called Myriad Genetics, Inc. Those patents were filed for two genes that are associated with breast and ovarian cancer, BRCA1 and BRCA2. In the end, the court decided that merely isolating a naturally occurring gene is not an invention because the gene is a product of nature which cannot be patented. On the surface, the decision appears to benefit academic researchers and nonprofit research institutions, allowing them to share genomic data more openly and freely. In addition, the decision should open up the market for genetic testing providers, increasing competition and reducing the costs of these services. Meanwhile, biotech companies who hold Myriad-style patents would appear to be the losers, as the decision puts these patents at risk of being invalidated. But will academia and industry really be affected by this decision? No, not really. I don't think so. That's because the court upheld the patentability of modified gene sequences, such as a complementary DNA, or plasmid sequences, or viral vector sequences. And those might be worth significantly more in terms of future revenue than the original gene sequence. In addition, as researchers have sequenced more and more human genomes, the patentability of naturally occurring human genes has probably already been compromised based on a lack of novelty. For example, the decision will allow other companies to begin testing patents for BRCA1 and BRCA2 genes, which could reduce the cost of those genetic tests through competition. However, if another company uses methods or cDNA sequences that Myriad has already patented, they would be infringing upon those patents. Some scientists have already argued that there's really little difference between naturally occurring DNA and DNA synthesized in the lab, but the court believes that a technician is indeed creating something new. The upshot of all this? leads to a serious loophole that I am not sure from a legal standpoint I can even address very well. Just how much of a gene has to be re-engineered by the technician before that gene now belongs to your company to be patented? Can you change one base pair and is it now a new gene? 10 base pairs? 100? 1,000? Will patentability be based on a certain percentage of genetic engineering alteration? I have no idea. And frankly, I'm not sure that anybody else does either. Oh, and just as a postal script to the story, the breast cancer gene tests are the bread and butter of Myriad Genetics Company right now. They make up about 80% of their overall revenue. So it's actually not a big surprise that a day after that Supreme Court ruling, Myriad Genetics stocks dropped by over 17%. And from what I've seen, they've actually dropped quite a bit more since then. Oops. Now, the next story should make those of you who still insist that plants can communicate telepathically feel somewhat justified. Doctors Monica Gagliano and Michael Renton of the University of Western Australia published a paper this month in the journal BMC Ecology that suggests that healthy plants communicate and can encourage each other to grow. Now, I am still not sure exactly what that means, but let me tell you what the authors did. Gagliano and Renton showed that chili plants sprouted faster and were healthier compared with those grown in isolation when they were grown next to quote-unquote good neighbors such as basil that help inhibit weed growth and pests. Remarkably, the scientists got the same result even when the plants were separated by black plastic so that they could not exchange light or chemical signals. Somehow, the chili seedlings could tell what kinds of plants their neighbors were and respond accordingly. Gagliano speculates that the answer involves acoustic vibrations generated, either intentionally or not, inside plant cells. These are known, by the way, as thigomorphic signaling processes. Gagliano thinks acoustic signaling would be a rapid and easy way for plants to identify their neighbors and anticipate their actions. In contrast, chemical signaling involves the production of specialized molecules and receptors, which is costly from a resource perspective. Renton states, quote, "Whatever the signal is, we don't know if the plants produce it for the purpose of signaling or if it is an accidental byproduct that other plants just eavesdrop on," unquote. There are other unknowns as well. What structures are plants using to talk to and listen to one another? And can insects and animals spy on plant conversations and exploit them for their own purposes? To all these things, Gagliano replies, quote, "We don't know, but the data are here. Plants are doing something. I can't fully explain it, but that doesn't mean it's not happening," unquote. Note, by the way, that she never mentions telepathy. I'm just saying, it was not one of the options suggested. Speaking of plants, here's another story from the latest issue of the journal Biotechniques. Dr. Kyle Taylor has begun a Kickstarter campaign to create glowing plants to replace street lamps. Yes, you heard that correctly. Taylor wants to create glow-in-the-dark trees to illuminate your way home at night. The foundation for Taylor's Glowing Plants Project, as he calls it, lies in decades of other scientists' work with luciferin, the bioluminescent compound found in fireflies, and the sequencing of genes that give animals like jellyfish their natural fluorescent glow. The Glowing Plants team used sequence analysis software to design DNA coding for a fluorescent protein that can be inserted into the genome of the plant Arabidopsis. According to the article, the plan is to fabricate the DNA using a 3D laser printer and then move it into a plant. I have no idea what that even means, and frankly, I don't know how you can make DNA with a laser printer, but what the heck, whatever they say. According to the project's Kickstarter page, more than 5,000 people have already pledged donations, totaling almost $300,000 to fund this research. Based on that financial support and feedback, The team plans to have its first glowing plants ready by May 2014. But Taylor says he hopes the project does not stop there. Quote, "There's a huge potential to use this technology to solve interesting problems, hopefully adding real-world value. What applications this technology could inspire are only limited by our imagination," unquote. He cautioned, of course, that these new innovations have to meet current regulations and that it's beholden to us as early pioneers in this space to approach these issues appropriately to protect future research. Okay, it does sound very cool, but here's a little problem. I only see it as cool as long as they can fit all those trees and bushes and tulips with off switches. Let me put this bluntly. Frankly, as cool as this idea is, it is equally stupid. It just seems to me that light pollution is already pretty awful across the entire world. Could you imagine if we had light-producing forests and trees and bushes and plants everywhere? Our children's children would never see the night sky again. It's just something to think about. Okay. For the next story, I will try to titillate you for the third month in a row with a sex story. I keep trying with these, but they never seem as sexy when I start to talk about them as they are when I first read them. This story has to do with chicken penises. I bet you've never seen one. There's a good reason for that. Male chickens lose them at a very young developmental age. In fact, male chickens, quail, and most land birds have virtually no protruding outgrowth of their sex organ, which would seemingly make reproduction rather difficult. In fact, only 3% of bird species have a penis structure to aid internal fertilization. And now, scientists are finally beginning to understand why. Dr. Martin Cohen of the University of Florida has just published a paper in the journal Current Biology that explains what has happened to the chicken's penis. Cohen has shown that at later stages of embryonic development, male chickens start to express more of a protein called bone morphogenic protein, BMP4, in their developing genitalia. The excess protein increases programmed cell death in the region, cutting off penis growth, rather quite literally. The results could help scientists better understand the molecular pathway that leads to malformations and defects in other animals' reproductive organs. Cohen says, quote, "Genitalia are one of the fastest evolving organs in animals. This organ system is a good example of how an evolutionary developmental approach can provide insights into development that might not be learned from studying a single organism," unquote. To understand why most birds' penises have disappeared, Cohen studied genital development in chicken duck embryos. Contrary to his expectations, the genes associated with genital growth were expressed similarly in chick and duck genitalia. He also found similar rates of cell proliferation in the developing penises of chick and duck embryos. So he then tracked programmed cell death in the genitals of developing chick, duck, quail, and alligator embryos. Chickens and quails showed a high rate of cell death in the tip of the growing penis late in genital development, whereas ducks and alligators showed little, if any, cell death in that region. The researchers put a nail in the results of that study by showing clear evidence that the bone morphogenic protein was responsible for the shrinking penises by microsurgically implanting beads loaded with another protein called noggin near the developing penis. Noggin has the ability to inhibit bone morphogenic protein 4 activity. As a result, the cells in the chick's genital tissue continued to grow, preventing deterioration of the penis. And so, in essence, Cohen was able to get mutant chickens with hypergenital growth. Humans do have a BMP4 gene, but it's unclear if there are any human genetic defects that are due to its being misexpressed. Well, that's all from me for now. As always, take care. Remember to find an error for your computer accounts. Don't bother to look for chicken penises. And I hope I've inspired some of you. Until next time, this is Jim Campanella.